Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. Barracuda Networks, innovators of hybrid on-premises and virtual solutions for content security, network optimization, and data storage, benefiting more than 100,000 organizations worldwide. Barracuda.com. And the Walter S. Johnson Foundation.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. On today's show, a last-minute entry shakes up the Democratic race for lieutenant governor as California Republicans meet to plot a statewide comeback. And two horrible crimes shatter a sense of security in a San Diego suburb.
I'll be driving down the street or going somewhere, and I see some small children that are by themselves walking to or from whatever. And I've often thought, I don't think I would do that as a parent.
Also, without the glamour of Pac-10 sports, athletics leave their mark at community colleges.
The guys that we go after are the guys that have already screwed up. And so when we first get them in the door, it's like, hey, look, this is your second chance.
It's the California Report. If comedian Rodney Dangerfield ever entered politics, no doubt he'd run for lieutenant governor. It's really a job that gets no respect. In fact, the position is empty right now, and no one seems to care. But the Democratic race for lieutenant governor got a little more interesting Friday when San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom tossed his hat in the ring.
I want folks to know I'm not running against anybody. This is a race for lieutenant governor. And what I want to contrast and what I want to be afforded the opportunity is to make a case for tomorrow, not yesterday. But I want people to know what we've done in the past because it will give them a good sense of what I'm committed to doing in the future.
Newsom dropped out of the race for governor last year, saying he wanted to spend more time with his family. That was then. Both Newsom and his leading opponent, L.A. City Councilwoman Janice Hahn, are liberal Democrats. Hahn thinks in the end, her gender may make the difference.
But I think having the first woman lieutenant governor will give it the kind of, you know, high profile that I think it needs so that these kinds of responsibilities can be highlighted and be much more effective. May the best woman win.
On the Republican side, Governor Schwarzenegger has nominated State Senator Abel Maldonado to fill that vacancy in the number two spot, but his nomination has been held up by Democrats in the legislature. Maldonado will try to get some traction this weekend in Santa Clara, where the state Republican Party is holding its semiannual convention. The meeting comes as GOP candidates for governor and the U.S. Senate are hurling verbal bricks at each other, trying to prove who's the real conservative in the race and who's just faking it. Sacramento Bureau Chief John Myers is covering the convention in Silicon Valley this weekend, and he's here now. Hi, John.
Hi, Scott.
So here we are less than 3 months away from the June primary election. Schwarzenegger's termed out as governor, Barbara Boxer running for re-election to the Senate. With that as a backdrop, how does the big picture look for the Republican Party in California?
Well, you know, Scott, I think Republicans will tell you things look great, the things that you talked about there, you know, but the real question seems to be how much of that national political debate really matters when it comes to California politics. I mean, if you look at the voter registration data, it continues to show not only that California Republicans are the minority party, but they're actually losing ground on California Democrats. But, you know, and in those two big races for governor and Senate, the only competitive primaries are on the Republican side in California. So they're going to get a lot of attention. But really the question, is it the kind of attention they want or need to really win a state that is still leaning Democratic in almost every statewide candidate contest?
It's certainly both those races become very bitter. And there's, you know, in the party, a historic tug of war between the moderate elements of the Republican Party, such as it is, Tom Campbell's wing, I guess you could say, versus the more conservative base, which Assemblyman Chuck DeVore is more or less representing. What's the dynamic right now between those two camps? Is that what the fights are over?
The two candidates you mentioned for U.S. Senate, Tom Campbell, Chuck DeVore, you're right, they do represent very different approaches. The third candidate, by the way, Carly Fiorina, I think trying to align herself on that conservative side. But here's what I find puzzling. Tom Campbell is leading in just about every poll of rank-and-file Republicans for the U.S. Senate race. Now, that would seem to infer that moderate candidates are okay, but then you look at the governor's race and you see Steve Poizner, the incumbent insurance commissioner, who's doing everything he can to put distance between himself and his moderate Republican past on a lot of issues. And Meg Whitman, the other candidate, touting her conservative credentials, too. I think all of that will play well this weekend with that base. But unless a lot of California voters find a reason to move to the right of the political spectrum, I think it still leaves those candidates, you know, somewhat swimming upstream come November.
Well, nationally, the big news in the past few months has been the Tea Party. They've energized the more conservative voters throughout the country. And there's going to be a Tea Party rally Saturday at the convention, I understand. How is the Republican Party feeling about the relationship between it and the Tea Partiers?
Yeah, I think that's interesting. You know, a lot of political experts are still trying to get a read across the country on the Tea Party movement and whether the issues that those folks care about make them a good fit or not with any political group, of course, most likely Republicans. You're right, California Republicans are going to try to reach out to them. I actually spoke to the party chairman, Ron Narian, about that issue, and he says he thinks there is a clear nexus on the issues.
I think that this reflects that there's a commonality of interests here, and that our party is very concerned about bringing taxes down. We're very concerned about the skyrocketing national debt. So there's certainly synergy there on these important issues of taxes, spending, debt, and getting government under control.
John, I want to ask you a question about Meg Whitman. She is the former eBay CEO, of course, leading by double digits in most polls over Steve Poizner. And yet this week she got into a lot of hot water because she called more or less a press event but wouldn't talk to the press. Is that hurting her with anyone other than journalists who want to talk to her, do you think?
I think the story actually could resonate because Democrats and Whitman's opponent, Steve Poizner, have been trying to make the case that the wealthy Whitman is trying to win the race by spending money on ads and doing photo ops and ducking a debate on the issues. And so I think it could resonate. You know, interestingly enough, she and Steve Poizner are in fact debating on Monday night in Orange County. I think she's actually raised the stakes for that event because she's really poorly handled this whole issue of taking questions in an open format. So I think it could have the potential to be more than just the inside baseball kind of story.
So here we are, John. It's about 3 months away from the primary. What matters most right now for the candidates running for governor and Senate? Is it fundraising, name ID? What is it?
Well, certainly in the race for governor, I think it's momentum. It's not really money as per se, because Meg Whitman and Steve Poizner are both personally wealthy. They can spend what they want to on the race, especially Whitman, and she already has. I think it's really momentum and keeping the upper hand in this dialogue about who's best to be governor. And as far as the U.S. Senate, that is a really volatile race right now. You had a lot of accusations this week about Tom Campbell and his past on issues like terrorism, which has kind of become a third rail for Republican voters. And, you know, are you safe and strong enough on terrorism issues? And Campbell's been playing defense on that one. So that's a volatile race. But I really think momentum overall in both races is important. 3 months is a long time. We'll have to see.
All right. Sacramento Bureau Chief John Myers. He's covering the California Republican Party convention this weekend in Santa Clara. Thanks, John.
You're welcome.
And you can read John's blog, Capital Notes, or follow him on Twitter from the convention. Just look for a link at our website, californiareport.org. The San Diego suburb of Poway will celebrate the life of a 17-year-old girl found murdered last week. Chelsea King's body was found after a week-long search. Days later, the body of another missing teenage girl from San Diego County was also discovered. Both crimes are being linked to a convicted sex offender. The cases have caused parents to consider the safety of their own children, regardless of where they live. From KPBS in San Diego, Anna Tintakalis reports.
Okay, come on, let's go play. Come on, let's go play.
A long driveway leads to Becky Saga's suburban house. Saga lives in Escondido, about 30 miles north of San Diego. She's playing catch with two dogs on her spacious front lawn. 2 weeks ago, Saga was hiking through the trails of a nearby lake with her 5-year-old daughter. She heard something in the bushes that she thought was a deer. Out walked a man who turned out to be John Gardner, the suspect in Chelsea King's disappearance. King's body was found on the other side of that lake near his home. And the suspect was arrested 3 hours after Saga came face to face with him.
And just that feeling of like, you know, I can't believe we can come so close to being with these people, and that, you know, he could have lived in a great community that's just next door to ours.
Escondido is known for its big stucco houses in cul-de-sac neighborhoods nestled in rugged terrain. It's common to see kids riding their bikes or jogging. Saga says families feel a sense of security here.
I'll, you know, be driving down the street or going somewhere, and I see some small children that are by themselves walking to or from whatever. And I've often thought, I don't think I would do that as a parent.
That is generally not the case in southeast San Diego, an inner-city community about 30 miles south of Escondido. The area has one of the largest concentrations of gangs in San Diego County. It's also home to a lot of high-risk and serious sex offenders.
We have parents that deal with dangers every day.
Tasha Williamson lives and works in southeast San Diego. She's the mother of two teenage boys, a daughter, and a three-week-old son, whom she cradles in her arms. She says parents know gang shootings and sexual assaults are realities.
They know that crime exists here. They know that children get molested and raped and abducted and shot because we hear it. We see it. They live it.
And Williamson says parents have an unspoken rule to look out for other kids, and they're not afraid to have graphic conversations with them.
And I tell my kids that I'd rather, as harsh as this will sound, do not allow somebody to take you to a second location and torture you. So for me, I teach my children that you fight for your life where you are.
I got a couple of calls over here trying to get out the front gate.
Okay, thank you. I can go around.
Harry Shelton is the principal of Morse High School in southeast San Diego. He patrols his campus as hundreds of students take their lunch break. He says teenagers here know how to maneuver around danger.
They know to work in groups, walk together. You never really see them alone. And so they have cues. There are certain physical cues that occur, streaking cars, sounds, noises. They know where they are, and they go from point A to point B. They don't linger.
Community efforts to create safe pathways for students as they walk to and from southeast schools have resulted in fewer abductions, gang shootings, and fights. That reflects an overall trend in San Diego, where violent crimes such as rape and murder are also down. Michael Bronker works with young people at the Jackie Robinson YMCA in southeast San Diego. He says the falling crime statistics might be comforting for some families, but he says parents everywhere should always be on guard.
There's never been a more important time for parents to hug their children, to get close to them, and to really sit down and talk about this, as opposed to acting like it's just not happening. Oh, it happened in Poway, or it happened in Escondido, or it happened in another part of San Diego.
Brunker says that's because you never know when violent crimes might affect you, your family, or your community. And he says it's cases like Chelsea King and Amber Dubois that bring that attention home. For the California Report, I'm Anna Tentakulis in San Diego.
And we have a footnote to that story. Late Friday, Governor Schwarzenegger directed the State Sex Offender Management Board to review suspect John Gardner's parole records to see if policy changes could help protect the public. College sports in the West are dominated by the Pac-10 Conference, where schools like Stanford, Cal, and USC often dominate. But well inside the shadow of those teams, 100 community colleges in California also have athletic programs. And for many of these athletes, sports is their ticket to a four-year university. This weekend, 8 men's basketball teams from throughout the state will play in the California Community College Championship, and hundreds of recruiters will be watching. April Demboski reports.
It's 5 minutes into the second half of this playoff game, the City College of San Francisco Rams versus Hayward's Chabot Gladiators. City has a 20-point lead. Number 34 sprints under the basket for a pass, a mane of dreadlocks trailing after him. He shoots. He scores. Deron Sims grew up in West Oakland, surrounded by drugs and violence. He played for a championship basketball team in high school, but his GPA took a nosedive his sophomore year, and that put Division I out of the question.
A lot of players end up at a junior college. Either they didn't handle their business in the gym and on the court, or it was school-wise.
After high school, Sims spent more time in county jail on drug charges than on the basketball court.
Every day I walk up and down the street, I see people that knew me in high school, middle school, and all that. They tell me, like, man, you really could have made it. Like, you really was talented. You still can if you try.
He decided to try. He trained 3 hours every day and asked the City College coaches to consider him for the team. Assistant coach Adam DeQuisto liked what he saw.
The guys that we go after are the guys that have already screwed up. And so when we first get them in the door, it's like, hey, look, this is your second chance.
Besides a state championship title, the guys all want the same thing, a full scholarship to a four-year college.
Like my family, we're not wealthy like that, but we can take care of our own.
Sims' teammate Christopher White is a 6'4" guard from Chicago.
At the same time, I would need for my schooling to be paid for completely for me to go to university.
Most of these players are the first in their families to go to college. Most are African American. Both factors make them much more likely to drop out. City College head coach Justin Labaugh says the basketball program provides the structure and discipline that keeps kids on track.
70% of my job is just navigating these guys through junior college. You know, the basketball is only 30%. And so it's just kind of organizing them and holding them accountable and talking with teachers. You know, we do all that kind of stuff.
Coaches email teachers regularly and check classrooms to make sure players are there. If they're not, they're sent to the track at 6 a.m. to run, or they don't play. The teachers love the coach's involvement.
Let's see, we've got a lot to do today.
Professor Deborah Stewart has several basketball players in her African-American consciousness class.
I have pleaded and begged, please do your assignments, get to class on time. When I send that out to the coach, no problem. Assignments are done, class on time, sitting in the front of the class, participating.
Okay, see, Felipe, do you have your hand up? Questions?
Once they get to a four-year college, students don't get as much support, and a lot of them slip up. New research from the National Collegiate Athletic Association shows that only 65% of two-year transfers get their BA, while 80% of athletes who start at a four-year college right after high school get theirs. The NCAA has started cutting scholarships at schools that don't graduate their athletes. Advocates are afraid community college athletes will get squeezed out. Carlisle Carter is the CEO of the California Community College Athletic Association.
We'll see fewer and fewer two-year college kids that will be recruited onto four-year college campuses, and that door will close.
Sophomores at City College are feeling the pressure. Still, coaches expect at least four of them to get scholarships, including Deron Sims.
Well, a lot of the schools that I talk to, they see me play, but they ask about school more than anything. And that's kind of what I like about it. Because I don't want to feel like they're just using me. I want them to actually be there for me and be able to help me in school.
Sims has offers from two Division I schools already, with several more likely to roll in after the playoffs. For the California Report, I'm April Dembosky.
This week, our occasional series on California songs continues with singer-songwriter Sean Hayes. Like many others who call San Francisco home, Hayes is an East Coast transplant. He found inspiration for his song Dolores Guerrero in the city's Mission District.
Dolores Guerrero is named after two streets in San Francisco, Dolores Street and Guerrero Street. But the song is inspired by when I moved into my new flat in 2006, which just happened to be the anniversary of the 1906 earthquake. The 100-year anniversary was coming up. When we moved in, we learned all these stories, and so the song is kind of chock full of all these stories.
No one knows. No one knows where the water came from. No one knows. No one knows where the water came from.
also just living in this house, it kind of evoked these spirits in a lot of ways of wow, this house was here before the earthquake, and so there were people living here when that happened. And it's also, you can just so easily research things now, which is great. So you immediately just get on Google and start pressing things in, and all these amazing stories kept popping up about the earthquake. So in some ways it was the house itself that wrote the song. I just had to sit there and look things up, and it just came out.
City's burning, mayor, why your soldiers murdering?
The mayor at the time decreed that anybody caught looting would be shot on the spot, which was actually a completely illegal thing for him to do. So there were actually people murdered who might have just been searching through their own rubble or trying to find food, who knows what reason. So just that story in itself goes on and on.
Dolores Guerrero, Dolores Guerrero, Dolores Guerrero, Dolores Guerrero.
I think it definitely, that first few weeks even of moving into this house and then learning about these stories deepened my appreciation and my knowledge of where I was. And being able to sing about it and kind of just put a little, you know, notch in the story or a little piece of information to help continue the story makes me feel more connected to this neighborhood and the city that I love.
Dolores Guerrero can be found on Sean Hayes' 2007 album, Flowering Spade. When huge earthquakes hit Haiti and Chile recently, teams of doctors from California flew there to help. But physicians in disaster zones are often hampered by the lack of a critical need, often taken for granted, reliable power. Rachel Dornhelm has this profile of a California couple whose handmade solar power kits are filling that need.
It's really important that you remember what to do when you're in the field. So I'm going to open up one of the solar suitcases, and let's just start by seeing if you can remember all the different parts of the solar suitcase.
Laura Stachel is crouching on the floor of her Berkeley kitchen. She lifts the cover of a black carry-on. There are no clothes inside, just a sheet of plywood mounted with four electrical components.
Okay, do you remember what these wires are for?
These are the external connectors that go to the solar panel.
That's right.
These fit into the circuit breaker.
Right.
Stachel's quizzing aid volunteer, Paul LeCoursiere, who's leaving for earthquake-ravaged Haiti in a few days. He's going to take this solar suitcase with him and plans to deliver it by donkey to a remote medical clinic that currently depends on candles for light.
Right. So we have a charge controller that's regulating the energy that's coming in from the panel. It's allowing
Stachel sounds like she might be a solar engineer. She's actually a medical doctor, an obstetrician whose idea for the suitcase spun out of her work on maternal child health in Nigeria. She says she was observing a hospital there in 2008 when she realized for several hours each day, power was rationed.
One of the first cases that I watched, which was a C-section, the lights completely went out during a C-section and the physicians had to finish by flashlight. There were other situations where midwives were taking care of women who were bleeding to death who needed emergency surgeries, but there was no phone system to actually call a doctor.
Stachel says she described the problems in emails to her husband, Hal Aronson, who does work on solar for a living. He suggested a sun-powered solution. When she got home, they designed a large permanent solar installation for the hospital. But Stachel insisted on a test run first.
I asked him to create something I could bring in my suitcase that I could take through customs without having to declare any special equipment, and that would allow me to show the workers in the hospital what LED lights were like, how walkie-talkies worked, how we could charge rechargeable batteries for headlamps.
Stachel says no one at the Nigerian hospital would let her take the trial suitcase away. And suddenly, she was getting requests for suitcases from medical clinics all over Nigeria. More recently, from all over the world. Their organization, We Care Solar, was born, says Aronson.
We didn't mean to turn our house into the solar suitcase factory, but it happened. It's been fun.
The suitcases don't just provide light and communication, but can be expanded to power ultrasound and suction machines and other basic medical equipment. Stachel estimates it costs about $1,000 for the materials in each suitcase. They're scraping together those funds from their savings and donations. That cost doesn't include labor, but Stachel and Aronson's infectious enthusiasm has been a boost, netting help from UC Berkeley students, solar hobbyists, and even high schoolers.
And now we're beginning to drill the holes in the template where all the wire is going to eventually go.
Like this engineering class at Cosumnes Oaks High School, just outside Sacramento.
I'm Kyle Betancourt. I'm a sophomore. I think it's really cool that we can help save lives in just other countries without even having to be there.
Betancourt's teacher attended a solar education workshop Aronson led last summer. He heard about the suitcases and thought they'd be a great project for his students. So far, the class has made 12 suitcases. They're working on 4 more that UNICEF requested for Uganda. Stachel says there are about 20 units now working in Nigeria, Tanzania, Mexico, Haiti, and the Thai-Burmese border. She says she and her husband are trying to keep up with demand while continuing to raise funds.
One of our dreams is to be increasing the capacity locally by increasing training, by getting shipments of equipment into countries, and to teach people how to make solar suitcases where they live so they can have their own industries and they can be supplying these things for their own communities and healthcare centers.
In the meantime, there's a steady stream of visitors to their house. Before Le Coursier leaves, Stachel brings a big bag of accessories to add to the suitcase. There are extension cords, batteries,
multiple light bulbs, headlamps, anything that you would want to use with the kit we put in there. We also have an instruction manual, and we have this so far in English. We have a translation to French, and Paul's team is working on making a translation to Creole for us for Haiti.
She shuts the suitcase.
Okay.
And gives it a last pat.
I always feel like I'm like handing off one of my offspring
here. I can understand that.
Le Coursier leaves, but Stachel and Aronson remain at the table, working over another set of solar panels.
And I turn around, I get out all the little metal shavings so it doesn't short circuit. And you can see this is nice and sturdy.
An African doctor headed to Zimbabwe is coming by for this suitcase within the hour. For the California Report, I'm Rachel Dornhelm.
And that's our show for today. California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. Seal Muller is the technical producer. We had additional engineering by Howard Gelman. Our interns are Caitlin Esch, Jennifer Bidas, Tracy Sharman, Kelly Mahan, and Julia Simon. Mike Lee produced our California song. Gabriel Cohen is our online editor. The producer is Victoria Maleon. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. Raul Ramirez is our executive producer. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by Chevron, an energy company encouraging innovation right here in California. This is the power of human energy. Information available at chevroncalifornia.com. The California Healthcare Foundation, sponsor of calqualitycare.org, a new online guide to long-term care in California. And URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. URSCorp.com.